The opinions expressed in our talk shows are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WGCH Radio.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to Defiant Hustle Radio on this swampy Wednesday. We're getting used to this weather now here in the Northeast. For some reason, it's as if we're in London or something. It's really damp, but it's a lovely day in the studio here at WGCH on Lewis and Mason Street in Greenwich. And I want everybody to really listen to this program. I think we're going to have one of the best programs we've ever had on Defiant Hustle Radio. But first, before we get into our guest, I want to introduce my co-host, Kelly.
Hello, everybody.
And at the controls tonight, we've got Josh.
Yeah, it's a good thing you saved the best for last.
Well, you know what? And this is Josh's last show.
Yeah, Josh, this is your last show,
this
right?
This is my last show at the station.
Look brighter. You look happier already.
Yeah, I wore jeans today.
Yeah, you look. So. You actually are dressed.
Yeah.
So that's a good thing. And then, Kelly and I have been preparing for the show this week, as we always do. And so, Kelly, why don't you talk about some of the things we've done?
I started to go through the news, and lately some of the top stories was money laundering, sex cults, corporate fraud, domestic abuse, embezzlement, just the general, the usual. And so on that note, it was yesterday the United States Attorney's Office in the District of Connecticut just released that Paul Glieno, who's the founder and chief executive officer of the United States Pain Foundation, just pleaded guilty in Bridgeport to fraud and tax evasion charges stemming from $1.5 million of embezzlement from the nonprofit. And then also not paying taxes on what he stole.
I guess when you steal it, you don't pay the taxes right away.
Right. And then recently, this came out May 2nd, and this is about John Kapoor, who's the founder of Insys Therapeutics. So he and four former executives were convicted Thursday. And let's go to Connecticut News to hear a little bit more about
this. It's a pharmaceutical, yeah.
Founder of the pharmaceutical company Insys, which prosecutors went after for contributing, they say, to the opioid epidemic that's killed thousands across the state and the country, really. So what did they all do? Well, Kapoor and four other former executives were accused of conspiring to bribe doctors around the country, offering them cash so that they would then prescribe the company's new drug on the market, a fentanyl-based spray used by cancer patients in pain. Now, fentanyl, as we know now, is a highly addictive synthetic opioid, and prosecutors said the five would get doctors to prescribe it to patients who didn't even have cancer in some cases, all to turn a profit. Now, they were all found guilty here this afternoon of racketeering, and that is a...
That wrapped it up very succinctly. Connecticut News talking about, again, John Kapoor, the founder of Insys, who seemed to have lost his moral compass.
Yes. So the news today is just... I wouldn't say it's just disturbing, but... You know, you're hearing more and more about white-collar crimes, and I think we're going to have a fascinating conversation because our guest in the studio with us today is the co-founder of Progressive Prison Ministries out of Woodbury, Connecticut?
And Greenwich.
Mm-hmm. And, and then he's known as the minister to the hedge fund managers. And his name is Jeff Grant. And you, Jeff... You work with white collar criminals, and we were talking outside a little bit about whether business was improving, which would be a sad thing, but whether business was improving a little bit when you're counseling white collar criminals.
Yeah, and their families.
So and their families.
There's a lot of misunderstanding about what really goes on in the mind of people who are prosecuted for white-collar criminals and why they do these things. And certainly their families are suffering and their children and their spouses. And so we kind of get into all of that and try to help people through. And just to be clear, based upon what Kelly said at the outside of the show, I can speak on any of these subjects except for the sex cults.
That's
the piece
cults.
I don't know about
that's
at all.
Hollywood. We'll leave that one to the West Coast. But that is
I don't know anything about that.
I looked down at my phone, which it pulls up the New York Times top stories, and the very first story just about an hour ago was sex cults. I was like, all right, add that to the list of weird news.
Yeah.
But so I wanted to – so you work with people as they're going into – at what point in the cycle do you come in?
Almost anything is the point of entry, because what happens is that when people are going through these issues, they start scouring the internet, doing searches, trying to find help. There have been a lot of articles about our ministry for a lot of reasons. One, I mean, certainly locally, because we were founded in Greenwich, we've been in all the press and media around here. But on a national level, our ministry is national, and we have people we work with. We call them ministries. Mm-hmm. We work with them all over the country. So there's a lot of hits on the searches, and you can understand people are suffering, and they can be up all night looking through, trying to find help. And they find us, and so I can wake up on any given morning to 5 or 10 emails or Instagram messages. Or
are they typically from the people who are being, let's say, they're being charged with the crime, or are they from people who love them?
That's the greatest opening question. I can't even tell you, because 50% of the messages we get are from spouses or family members, mostly because they're very, very concerned, and the people who are being accused or prosecuted for the crimes, they're kind of locked up. You know, they're in trauma. I mean, not that their family members aren't in trauma, but it's a family issue, and I would say that, you know, it's a predominantly male issue. I mean, there are certainly a lot of women now who are accused of and prosecuted for white collar crimes, and that's actually growing. But as a percentage, it's still very, very small. So we hear from wives, mothers, brothers. I had lunch today in Greenwich with someone who's been prosecuted and found guilty of a white collar crime, and he found me because his brother saw me on a podcast. We can mention other podcasts, I
assume. Absolutely.
So the Rich Roll podcast, and Rich Roll has a very widely watched podcast, and so I've been hearing from probably 10 times as many people in the last few months as we did previously. And everybody gets a call back or a message back immediately, same day.
Right.
That doesn't mean I can get to everybody and talk to them the same day. But when people are suffering, I want them to know that there are people out there who are there for them, and they're not alone.
So this is, we're talking about the Progressive Prison Ministries.
Yeah, prisonist.org.
Prisonist.org.
It's the easiest way to find us.
So what do you do? So I write to you, and I'm like, oh, this is happening, and I can't believe it's happening, and either I'm going to prison, or potentially going to prison, or I'm in prison, or somebody I love is, and what are you going to help me with?
Well, the biggest problem that people have is that they're in trauma, and they can only see what's right in front of them. So, for example, if they've been arrested, or they've been, or they're already in the prosecution portion of the problem, and they can only see that there are lawyers, and that they're going to maybe go to prison, and they're going to be no longer be able to work in their profession. For example, if it was a lawyer or a doctor or a financial person, and so whatever's right in front of them is basically a year or 2 year period, sometimes longer, but what they don't have are any allies or coaches or quarterbacks to help them through what's going to be inevitably a 10-year period. And so to have goals set so that on the other side of these problems that I can live a happy, healthy, fulfilling life, and different than the life I led before probably and almost always. But the worst thing in the world, I think, is to be 10 years out. So it could be a 35-year-old person, and now they're 45 years old, and they look back and they say, I wish I had known then what I know now, my entire decision-making process would have been different. And so what we provide is that long view on everything. And since we've been doing this for 10 years now, we have people who have come to us at the beginning of their process. They've been, say, just arrested. And now they've been through the prosecution process. They've been through trial. They've been through sentencing. They've been to prison. And they come back. And now we help them ease back into a career, find solutions for their lives that we anticipated 6, 7, 8 years ago.
Right.
A lot of that is done through our support group that we have on Monday nights. So we have a white-collar and nonviolent support group that meets online every Monday night, the first one in the country.
Uh-huh.
And Noreen, it's fascinating. It's unbelievable because it's on video, it's on Zoom.
Mm-hmm.
And so these are people all over the country who've never met one another in person when they first come on. And they're just little boxes of video on the screen.
Right. I take a lot of online classes. Yeah, I offer them.
But they're suffering and they're in isolation and they've never been able to talk to anybody about their issues because one, their lawyers won't let them, or two, their friends and their business associates have shunned them or mm-hmm. cast them off. And now they can't even talk to their spouses really because these issues are so internalized. And now to be in a room or even a virtual room with people who have gone through the same thing they're going through is just this beautiful gift and certainly the most fulfilling part of my week every week.
You would say 10 years out, they're at the beginning of, you said, potentially 2 years of going through, I guess, the courts or potentially even the prison system.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
But you said 10 years out. So what does somebody need to know now that's going to save them? That they should have known 10 years out, like they wish they knew. What are you teaching them up front helping them with?
Well, it's on a lot of different levels.
Right.
I mean, spiritually, certainly. And that's the thing the thing that we try to do mm-hmm. with me and my wife, Lynn Springer, was a co-founder.
Right.
But now we have other people on our team and in our ministry. What we try to do is we try to help them make the move from a material way of life more to a spiritual way of life. And spirituality is different for different people. I mean, we're not trying to, you know, proselytize or prescribe any specific way. What we're trying to do is help them get back to that person that they were maybe at 12 years old
right.
before they started to be infected maybe by drugs or alcohol or at least earlier in their life. And so while we're going through that process of trying to help them discover their authenticity, there are a lot of business issues and legal issues and tax issues. And the range is huge.
Practical and spiritual.
Oh, yeah. It all kind of comes together. And I can tell you, for example, with the conversation I had today,
mm-hmm.
Let's just take, for example, and again, I'm no longer a lawyer, so I don't give legal advice, but
right.
I work with their lawyers.
We're going to get into some of your background.
Right. So I do work with their lawyers,
right. uh-huh.
so I recommend everybody have lawyers. But an example is that most people will have restitution to pay,
mm-hmm.
some kind of restitution,
mm-hmm.
or there's going to be a civil forfeiture or a forfeiture of their property, or they have asset freezes. And what that means and how you can apply your assets in a way that's going to be most successful for you over the long haul is an important information to have. For example, restitution, important to pay, but taxes are also important to pay. And if you don't have enough money to pay restitution and taxes, then you've got to make a decision as to which one to pay, because people are no longer, most people going through this are no longer working in their career,
right.
or they have limited amounts of funds that they have to apply to legal fees, which could be huge. And so how to apply those monies so that when you go through the process in chief, say, and go, if you have to go to prison, you go and you come out, and then you're not saddled with this enormous amount of debt and this enormous amount of tax issues and is a plan that you really need to have at the very, very beginning.
You need to know what's at risk.
Of course.
Your house, you know, what to start to liquidate, if as the case may be, and what's not at risk.
And if you can liquidate. And of course, what happens in, I would say, almost all of the time, that these are mostly powerful men. And let's just talk about the men. I mean, it's true for women as well. But they're powerful men and who are suffering from all kinds of issues by the time this happens. You know, they've been looking over their shoulder and they've been afraid, or they've been afraid of getting caught for a long time.
Right.
And I would say that most of the men that we work with are suffering from some form of either drug and alcohol issues or mental illness, or some form of character issue where they were pushed beyond the place where they ever thought they would be in terms of their desperation, or their perhaps they're in a hedge fund or something where the demands become greater and greater and greater, and then the line of what becomes ethical becomes fuzzier and fuzzier, and then they wake up one day and they're on the other side of it. And so what's happened is that they need to be kind of brought back to center at a time when their wives, for example, have been pretty dependent upon them, and so they're reeling in this process, which is horrendous. And they're telling their wives, don't worry, I've got it worked out, which is probably what they've always told their wives, don't worry. And their wives have been trusting. But the truth is,
Well, Kelly and I were talking about this, and we want to come back to that intersection when they start to make that gray area where you're what used to be normal or moral for you starts to get pushed away.
Yeah.
But we were talking about the children, the wives. Mm-hmm. Do they typically, in your experience, are they just in denial? Do they have any idea what's going on? And if you are with somebody who's going down the wrong path or has gone down the... what can you start to do? Because typically, I mean, we've all have experience with people that may be testing our ability to forgive or understand whether they're... like, they're often very charismatic men,
maybe. Yeah.
And so I guess my question for you starts with, do the women have any inkling in when you see that there's something's going on, but they're just in denial?
You're asking the best questions, I have to tell you, because they're real. You know, the real, let me answer it two ways. The first is that most of the men, what they have is they have a fractured ego structure.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they've had it for a long time, but they certainly have it at that point. And what they don't have, and they desperately want, is the ability just to walk into the bedroom and tell their wives, look, I've crossed a line, or I'm about to cross a line, or something's wrong. And they don't have that intestinal fortitude, because they're afraid. They're afraid to tell the truth to their spouse, and they're afraid mostly because they're afraid their spouse is going to leave them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a terrifying thought, but it makes them come to terms with the fact that maybe for a long period of time, many of them haven't been present in the relationship. You know, they've been overworking.
Right, no doubt.
Been overworking.
And getting a lot of accolades.
Yeah, sure, of course.
Because society, and I wanted to talk to you about the American dream and morality, but for society, we'll say, well, you're smart. They're usually highly, highly intelligent men and women, as the case may be. And society saying, look what they've done. They've done all these things. They've created all these things. They've made all this money. And so you're validated, and your family's validated.
And that, you know, it's compounded to, like, specifically we're just sticking with men, but in society, you guys are the providers. You're supposed to take care of the home. And so to have that responsibility with also then that men are taught not to feel anything really other than anger. That's the only proper emotion that men can easily feel, easily own into. And so they have all these complexities, these fears, insecurities. And how do they even begin to own it up, you know, own up to it, feel it, and it just becomes this downward spiral that the tipping point, I'm sure, is different for everyone.
But at a time when they're clearly not actualized at that time, and now they're under huge amounts of stress, and what they want to do, and I can tell you that because I've spoken to hundreds and hundreds of men going through this, and myself included,
right.
That what they want to do is go and tell their wives, look, I'm not who I thought I was, or I'm not capable of doing what I thought I could do, or somehow I've missed the train here in terms of what the ethics or what life should be. And what we need to do is we need to simplify. And so that means we need to sell the house. We need to sell the cars. We need to this life, right. We can't shop for, as our hobby anymore. And so this life has to change, but it has to change now. And they're afraid that the only reason their wives are still with them is for the money,
right.
Because they've abandoned the relationship a long time ago.
Right.
And the hardest thing to hear, and I can tell you that I have been with couples and I've talked to them, the husbands and the wives, the hardest, the most heartbreaking thing is that the wives would have liked nothing more than the husband they married to come to them, even if it's 10 years later, and say, I was wrong and I need you now and let's figure this out. Yeah, exactly.
I'm curious, did you ever have that conversation with your ex-wife?
Probably after it was too late. Everything I've learned about this I've learned through the eyes of other men going through it. So it wasn't as if like I had this amazing understanding or actualization about myself or my own behavior. Well, certainly I was at the time I was addicted to prescription opioids. And so that clouded everything.
Right.
But in talking to men who are going through this and asking them questions like, do you realize that you hurt your wife, you hurt your children, you hurt your community? And many of them don't understand they've hurt anybody.
Capacity anymore.
Exactly.
Let's back up for the audience sake. All right. So we're talking with Jeff Grant.
We're talking with Reverend.
Yes, Reverend Jeff Grant.
We got the Reverend in the house.
Okay, that's fine. No worries.
Co-founder of Progressive Prison Ministries.
Yep.
So prisonist.org, if you're out there and you're hearing this. And
and then is it right to your executive director of?
Yes.
The family reentry.
No longer.
Okay.
But I was executive director of family reentry until January of this year. And that's a whole story. But I'm so grateful to them for having appointed me as executive director of that criminal justice organization, which is Connecticut-based, you know, headquarters in Bridgeport. But they made me the first person in the country who was incarcerated for white-collar crime to be appointed as the head of a major criminal justice organization.
Yeah.
So I'm forever grateful.
We're
going
to
have
you
back.
And then
I apologize. I was cutting Noreen off as she was talking to the audience of, like, if you're a family member, if anyone's going through this, prisonist.org.
Prisonist.
Yeah.
So just to take the audience through your life,
sure.
Which we could spend the whole show on, but just so that they can understand what brought you to this place today. So you grew up in Boston. You were born in Boston. You grew up on Long Island.
Exactly.
And then you went to New York Law School, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you became a hotshot, right? A corporate and real estate lawyer.
Yep. I represented some major real estate companies.
In New York City?
In the metro area. But name brands. I mean, names you'd know.
Okay, okay. So I came out of the real estate private equity industry, yeah. So I can relate to some of the incredibly wonderful things and insanity and some of the darker things that go on there.
Yeah.
And so you're a lawyer there. You're well, take me back. We're in the middle of the 90s?
This is mid-90s.
And you're how old?
And I'm in my early late 30s, early 40s at that point.
Okay, so like and really just, at a
and it was you know and it was crazy working around the clock, doing deals, getting things done. I had a private practice going as well. I had 20 people working for me, and then they had hundreds and hundreds of people, maybe thousands, working for them.
Really?
And I was involved in all of it, and it was take no prisoners. Uh-huh. And it got to me. And then when I got hurt in a sports injury, I was given opioids, right. At that time Demerol. And I became addicted to it. And so...
And this is where, sorry to interrupt, I was just a little confused. Had you done opioids before? Had you done drugs? Okay.
For sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's not as if I was a... I was a saint. I was a... I thought like a normal New York guy.
Right.
Who, you know, who partied a little bit. And yeah. And I tried a little bit of everything. Well, almost everything. And in varying degrees through all those years, but not like what happened after, you know, after in the 90s to me,
right.
where every single day and I was getting prescriptions two and three times a week. It was madness.
So you had somebody who was helping perpetrate it, allowing it to happen on your behalf.
I don't blame the
We're
doctors.
You know,
no, I don't. There's no blame.
Somebody's facilitating.
But there's no question that I was
a doctor.
I was manipulating them as much as I could. I was a drug addict.
So take me back. So you're growing up on Long Island. Mm-hmm. Were you a bad kid? Did you see this side of yourself, or and like at what point does it because it's not just you, Jeff, it's so many of us come to this crossroads. So when do you get into it?
You know, I was when I was young, like up until in elementary school, uh-huh. And in early junior high, I was one of those kids who was the smartest kid in the class. It's uh-huh. So, maybe the smartest kid in the grade. Uh-huh. And then I found some kids who were partiers, and they found me, and I'm not, again, no blame here, but I definitely took a turn away from what my core was and what my strengths were.
As a teenager.
And we all do that. Yeah, sure. And I did well enough to get into law school, and I did well enough to be successful, but I would say that I never reached what my potential was, and part of that was because I had never given up early in my life. I had never given up alcohol or drugs.
No, nobody was giving up alcohol or drugs.
And all my friends were the same way. So it was hard to judge.
Right, and then so you go out, but let's say you go out into the real estate world in New York City, and everybody's making the 90s. In the early 2000s, and even now, apparently, if you put on the news,
sure.
But that 90 was the buildup of this pace of money being made hand over foot, and mostly men, and then the women were getting involved. I thought the women were complimenting it. We were helping to – I think women fall under a spell of powerful men, and Kelly and I were talking about that, but the men were so intelligent, and then they seemed to regress into children.
Infantile behavior.
Infantile behavior.
There's no doubt.
Of sex, drugs, I'm going to say theft, or pushing the line into something
there's no question.
Because they were so creative about how to make money, so there was always a line, and then they were evading.
Right, I think, too, when you get a taste of power, and then it's just, okay, what can I push the boundaries on? I can get everything. What's next? Give me more.
You know, I see it a little bit differently,
okay.
and it's true all that happened, and I lived through all of that.
Right.
But I see it as a decay of morals from early life, and that somewhere post World War II, I guess, we stopped teaching our children mm-hmm. that character is the most important thing in the world. Mm-hmm. And so if you go back 100 or 150 years, ethics was the core, the core curriculum of every university. Seminaries were the first colleges in this country. Mm-hmm. I mean, the core of that ethics and morality was there. And whether or not you deviated from it, you grew up, this is before my time, but you grew up understanding that that's what the core responsibility of being a person was. Somewhere in the 50s, universities, for example, stopped using being the core of that, and they became professional schools. So ethics wasn't the core anymore. Now it was delegated to the business schools, for example.
It was making business
ethics, yeah. Whatever that means. Uh-huh. And so they were self-regulating, self-policing. They made up their own language. And so that for the next 50 years beyond that, there was a breakdown in actual character building. And there's a backlash now. There's no mm-hmm. question. I mean, people are much more concerned now about these things, and it's certainly a dinner table conversation in terms of crime and criminal justice. And you can talk about it now in polite company, but certainly for many, many years you couldn't.
I was thinking about, okay, we live in a town of very successful people here, yeah. mm-hmm. but even if you don't, there's the American dream about having it all and making a lot of money and being successful. How does that play into risk-taking? Because a lot of the people who are taking the risks are from even very affluent families.
I'll tell you what the single biggest problem is that the rewards are so great mm-hmm. that people are willing to take the risk. So we can be in front of a room full of young finance people mm-hmm. and we can tell them our cautionary tales, we can tell them what happened to us, we can talk about other people, but if you as a young person, by taking risk, and that's personal risk that could push you over the line into potentially illegal behavior, mm-hmm. but the reward is tens of millions of dollars,
right.
It's out of balance. People are willing to take that risk,
right?
Because it's an absurd amount of money, it's crazy amount of money.
And if you get punished legally for it, will you tell me what you think? Because it seems like it's worth it to go and get it, and then you pay this little fine, or maybe you go to prison for you, but you still have your money.
Here's the thing.
Why are so many people still doing it today? When you hear about money laundering and all these things.
Here's where I would like it to be. Here's what makes sense to me.
Okay.
To stand in front of a room of newbies at Goldman Sachs or any other company like that, to stand in front of them, whether there's 500 people in the room, and say to them, within 5 years, 2% of you are going to be prosecuted for some financial related crime. Now, I'm just making up that number. I'm not saying I don't have evidence for that number, but I'm just saying, so look around the room and 10 of you are going to be prosecuted. And that means your families, that means your careers, that means and you don't know who it's going to be because you have no idea what you're going to be called to do over the next 5 years.
Mm-hmm. So, especially as you go up the ladder.
Exactly.
Right. At the beginning, they're just sort of floating around.
Or, frankly, if they're looking for your boss or they're looking for your boss's boss, and the way prosecution works is they start at the bottom and they pick off the little people to make their way up to the big people.
What do you mean they? Who does?
The prosecutors, the investigators.
The prosecutors mm-hmm. pick off the little people.
Yeah, exactly.
So what they mean, they go after them and have them turn around and start to report.
Exactly.
On, well,
exactly.
So that's what I think must be happening.
It happens all over. Sure, of course. Okay. Mm-hmm, of course. Mm-hmm. So So it's not just your behavior, it's the behavior of the person sitting next to you at the next desk, or your boss's behavior. Anything can shine a light on negative behavior. So what are we to do about it? And the answer, I think the answer has to be that we need to have an effective way of telling people this is the line that we're unwilling to cross. And if it means that we're going to make less money, then we should be making less money because we're not supposed to cross that line.
Right.
And that's okay. And I can tell you that there are some companies, especially financial companies and certainly law firms, that will not cross that line. And that's something that I think should be industry-wide or every industry-wide.
It comes down to leadership.
Yep. Always, always, always.
And then, so even, so you get into these environments and the pace is fast. You almost don't even, if you're not an immoral person, you may not even recognize what's happening right away until you do. You know, like you start to wake up and realize something's going on. That's when you're immersed in it, and that's when you start getting tested.
It's a culture problem.
Okay.
You know, the culture is such that, look, if anyone's listening out there and people in the finance industry know a lot more about the specifics of this what's going on than even I do, and they could take the position, oh, well, that'll never happen to me, or I know what's going on, or what I'm hearing are simple solutions to complicated problems. Let me tell you that you can be the king of the hill today. But if the FBI taps you on your shoulder, all of a sudden you're in a different world. Your entire world is gone. Mm-hmm. And you are now in a world that you know nothing about. It's like a plane. You're on a plane and it lands in Mongolia. And now you're in Mongolia and you don't speak the language and you don't have Mongolian money and you don't know how to navigate. And that's it.
You're saying, let's say I'm working at the organization and I was a CFO, so I see numbers and see what was going on. I had a good perspective on everything that was going on. So you're saying at some point I'm just going to get thrust into a different world. If the FBI or if anybody comes in, I'm just off in a different world.
The world as you know it changes in an instant. But it could take a long time to get into acceptance of the fact that that the world that you were in is no longer available to you, and you are now in a world of being prosecuted and having different life options and different allies and different responsibilities, and your life for probably the next 10 years is going to be about this prosecution and how you're going to live your life and how you're going to keep your family together and how you're going to come out the other side of it and live a happy, healthy life, but it will probably be nothing like the life that you left.
And speaking about changing in an instant, we're going to take a break now.
Oh.
Yeah. So we have Reverend Jeff Grant, and that's Noreen Ehrlich on Defiant Hustle Radio. We'll be right back.
All right, we'll be right back. We're having a great conversation. Don't go away.
Connecticut Turnpike, still a lot of heavy volume. 50-minute ride from the state line up to Route 7 on the Turnpike. Northbound Merritt Parkway from Greenwich up to Norwalk. That's a 36-minute trip. You know, every 52 minutes, someone is killed by a drunk driver. Join Mothers Against Drunk Driving at a Walk Like Mad 5K near you. Sign up at walklikemad.org. I'm Jay Trelase, 1490 Traffic Center.
From the WGCH Weather Center.
Widely scattered rain showers for tonight, some patchy fog, lows 60 to 65. Tomorrow, a morning shower, then mostly cloudy with afternoon showers redeveloping near 70. Scattered showers, a few thunderstorms, a heavy downpour tomorrow night, 60 to 65, drying out on Friday. Stuck in jail? The Bail King is here to help. Bail Bonds Office is open in New York and Connecticut 24/7. Go to thebailking.com. I'm meteorologist Ryan Gallagher on 1490 WGCH.
What if I told you I could change your life in just 100 days? This is Noreen Ehrlich from Defiant Hustle Radio. I'm an executive coach based in Greenwich, Connecticut. For over two decades, I worked as a CFO and leader in Wall Street's fast-paced private equity industry.
I help guide teams of professionals to improve their careers, grow their businesses, and still maintain work-life balance. Based on this know-how and my unique understanding of life's principles, I created a 100-day plan that will unquestionably uplevel your life. Make 2019 your year. You can and deserve to have it all. Don't wait. Take advantage of my free 50-minute consultation by visiting my website at noreenerlich.com or calling me at 475-333-2173.
Good evening. Traveling the northbound Connecticut Turnpike, still a lot of heavy volume. 50-minute ride from the state line up to Route 7 on the Turnpike. Northbound Merritt Parkway from Greenwich up to Norwalk. That's a 36-minute trip. You know, every 52 minutes, someone is killed by a drunk driver. Join Mothers Against Drunk Driving at a Walk Like Mad 5K near you. Sign up at walklikemad.org. I'm Jay Trelase, 1490 Traffic Center.
From the WGCH Weather Center.
A few widely scattered showers for this evening. Some patchy fog late tonight, 60 to 65. And a morning shower passing through tomorrow, mostly cloudy. Afternoon showers redevelop with a high near 70. Scattered showers tomorrow night, a few thunderstorms. Some with locally heavy rainfall, 60 to 65. Friday, showers end, followed by increasing sunshine, turning breezy and less humid, highs in the mid-70s. I'm meteorologist Ryan Gallagher on 1490 WGCH.
Are you a business owner who's suffering from what I call the entrepreneur's dilemma? That means you have a successful business, but you're so caught up in operations that you are overwhelmed, maybe you're capital constrained, or you just know that you can scale your business to another level, but you need help doing that. This is Noreen Ehrlich from Defiant Hustle Radio. I'm an executive coach based in Greenwich, Connecticut. For over two decades, I worked as a CFO and CPA in Wall Street's fast-paced real estate private equity industry, where I helped start up and turn around hundreds of underperforming businesses. Based on this know-how, I created a 100-day plan that I tailor to your business to make sure that you streamline operations, drive performance, and generate profits fast. Don't wait. Take advantage of my free 50-minute consultation by visiting my website at noreenerlich.com or by calling me at 475-333-2173.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to Defiant Hustle Radio. This is Noreen Ehrlich, my co-host today, the beautiful, and I mean smart. That inside and intelligent. She gets upset, but I told her beautiful is an essence. It's not just an external thing. But that's Kelly over there.
Hello, everybody.
And we have Josh at the controls. And then we have our very special guest tonight, Reverend Jeff Grant. And he is the co-founder with his wife, Lynn, of the Progressive Prison Ministries, Inc., prisonist.org.
Exactly.
And you work with white-collar criminals,
and their families,
yep. Mm-hmm. And any other nonviolent crimes.
Yeah, it's kind of a fluid concept because, for example, you could be a finance person and you've had your third DWI and you're going to go to jail for a year. And when you come out, you have a felony. You're not going back to your job. They won't let you. Mm-hmm. So it's more about disenfranchised people who come from communities that don't have a lot of support and services.
The white collar.
Yeah, exactly.
But I mean, it is interesting. We were kind of talking about that too. It's like, how many friends do you actually keep when you go through a process like that? So the reentry can be so challenging, especially in these tight knit communities and wealth and la di da. The last name got trampled under, and And it's just, yeah, how do you re-enter? And yeah, so it's good to have you on.
Well, when I went through recovery here in Greenwich every day, actually for a while, three times a day.
You and were actually in
recovery.
I
did my rehab at Silver Hill, and then came out and I started going to recovery here in Greenwich. You know, I went to meetings.
For opioid addiction.
Opioid addiction and alcoholism.
And alcoholism.
Every single day.
So you've been sober now
for 17 years.
17 years. All right.
And in August it will be 17 years, if God willing, I get there.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
And one of the things that you learn in recovery is that you need different people, places, and things. And that made sense, but in my case, I didn't live where I could lived anymore because I couldn't, and none of the people that I knew would talk to me, mm-hmm. and I had none of the things that I used to have, so...
Did they trust you?
Did they say,
he's a dirtbag or something
no.
like that?
No.
What about people you thought were really friends that had nothing to do with the crime? Did they stay around or did they just say good things?
There are a couple, mm-hmm. but I was a big fish in a small pond. I was in Rye and Mamaroneck, and I had hundreds and hundreds of clients and friends. And, you know, when you're a successful guy, people want to be around you. Mm-hmm. And when this happened, it was in newspapers, and I tried to commit suicide, so you know that's part of my story. I didn't hear from almost anybody, maybe a handful, five people.
Because they were...
I was radioactive.
Yeah.
Judging you. Yeah.
Well, there's also nothing to gain. You know, when some people make friends just because you have money, once you're not the cool hot shot in town, it's just like, well, all right, who cares?
Yeah, no, I mean, not everyone has the same exact experience, but in my case... Because I held a lot of people's secrets. I was their lawyer, and that I was a dangerous person to have mm-hmm. around, mm-hmm. you know, because I think that was part of the reason. But regardless, my family and I were pariahs, and we had to we left Ryan and moved to Greenwich. I'm not sure that most people, when they lose their careers and their money, they move to Greenwich, but we did. And a lot of the reason was because I'd already been going to recovery here, mm-hmm. and I was doing well, staying sober. So I didn't want to interrupt that.
I wanted to ask you about forgiveness,
mm-hmm.
and whether it relates to you or it relates to people who really hurt a lot of people in the process. Mm-hmm. And that can be, if you think about, like, I don't know why his coming up, but when we did research, of course, mm-hmm. you get the Bernie Madoffs, or you're hurting your children and you're mm-hmm. destroying, really,
yeah.
your family and mm-hmm. people around you. And in the spiritual world, of course, we're taught about forgiveness, mm-hmm. and it probably is a little different than a lot of people were taught, where
sure.
it's like, oh, I
mm-hmm.
forgive you because mm-hmm. I'm a nice person. But when is forgiveness... How can forgiveness, this is a broad question, brace yourself, be applied? But you could, so that the person is being forgiven, but also is learning a lesson. That's a big question. You got 2 minutes.
Another great question. Look, the single biggest problem that people have when they're going through these issues, mm-hmm. White collar criminal issues, and almost any issue, really, is their their own self-criticism, their self-esteem is crushed, and we keep ourselves in prisons. Most of the world is not really thinking about us at all. You know, they've moved on, they're living their lives, and yet most of the guys I work with are unable, without help, they're unable to believe that they have any self-worth left, that they're children under God, that they're loved, that they've been forgiven. And until they forgive themselves, until I forgave myself, uh-huh. there was no way for me to move forward. And that's a process. That took a long time. And I can tell you, even now, I can wake up any single morning and be so racked with shame and guilt and
still are.
Still. And it doesn't happen often, uh-huh. and I can usually work my way through it. And part of that is through meditation and yoga
and service.
Yes. Service is huge. But, you know, these are life altering situations. Mm-hmm. And I've talked to many people going through these life altering situations, whether it's loss of a child or a death in the family, loss of a career. It's all pretty much the same, that you have to work yourself through it. And we help people work themselves through this so they can be happy, joyful, productive people again and put their lives back together.
One of the key aspects of your ministry?
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. But with on-the-ground, real, practical solutions. I mean, people have complicated issues. And because I've been a lawyer and a businessman, and I went through prisoner reentry and recovery and ministry and went to seminary and ran companies, this combination of things is fairly unique. And so to dedicate my life to helping people who are going through these issues at a time where their lives are so, where they're so vulnerable, is the greatest gift of my life. It's
for
my
sure.
calling.
And,
yeah.
And now you're developed. Yeah, yeah. You met your wife.
Like
Kelly.
And then as those, you're saying forgiveness is a huge part of it, but you have these practical, real steps and tools to help. And that you guys are also now focused on the ethical training and transformation, the ethical movement.
Yeah, I mean what we've done is we've created basically an ethical rehab kind of component. Mm-hmm. So for example, Tiger Woods, there's an example of someone who had ethical lapses, mm-hmm. and his wife chased him down the driveway with a 9-iron, and then he went to his lawyer and said, "What do I do? I mean, my life is over." He probably has $100 million a year of endorsements, and his lawyer said, "First, go to rehab, mm-hmm. come out of rehab, and then you've been able to evidence that you're a new Tiger Woods." And so we're interested in helping a person. And usually their legal issues are the thing that gets them to come in for the help. But we want to help them transform. We want to help them change. But that transformation and change will inevitably help them with their legal issues as well. So these things kind of dance with one another. And we want to help.
And we're so grateful that you are providing this help, because everyone does deserve a second chance, especially if they're willing to show up for it.
Yeah, thank you, Kelly. That's true.
20 seconds.
We have been speaking today with Reverend Jeff Grant, mm-hmm. of the Progressive Prison Ministries, which he co-founded with his wife, Lynn.
Yep.
And he is helping people to overcome and see their way through the issues they may be facing around any decisions they've made that have really turned on them, and he's the person to contact, he or his wife, or the person to contact, prisonist.org, to help figure out your way through the maze that may be out in front of you.
Quarterback them through
the mm-hmm. maze that may be out if you've made some wrong decisions and now have to learn how to unwind them in a healthy way and try and save what you can of your life and go forward in a better place.
Exactly.
So, thank you very much for being a guest on our show today. Good luck.
Thank you, Noreen.
Thank you,
Kelly.
Kelly.
Thank you.
Thanks,
Josh.
Everybody.
Thanks, everybody who's out there listening. I hope
hustle.
You're having a great week hereafter. We'll see you next week.
The Voice of Greenwich. This is 1490 WGCH Greenwich.
Mistaken identity. I'm Barbara Cusack. Former community.